Well, it seems that News of the World is making headlines of the News of the World as they face off in the legal battle in a phone hacking scandal. But here on the Fourth Estate, your weekly media and communications program that airs across the community radio network, we're more focused on the issues that are affecting you. My name is Meg Caldwell, and it's a pleasure to join you once again here on the show as we take a look at what's to come.
More people are shooting photos, for sure, but I think more people are interested in it. Photography's become a lot more accessible to people through whether it's an iPhone or through cameras that they've bought themselves, but it's no longer expensive with film and dark rooms and getting printing done and stuff. It can be all done at home on your home computer. So I think it's actually made people more aware and more interested in the art form of photojournalism.
We refocused the camera lens back into a world of quality photojournalism as the World Press Photography Prize makes its way, exhibiting itself across in Sydney. The Australian ballet industry being kept on its toes by embracing the market of social media and keeping a watchful eye on industry self-regulation within the notions of children and advertising. Stick around for these stories on the show that is The Fourth Estate. Throughout July, the State Library of New South Wales is once again exhibiting World Press Photography alongside the Sydney Morning Herald Photos 1440. While the World Press Photography exhibit confronts and intrigues with images that detail some of the world's most devastated and dangerous locations, 1440, by contrast, is a collection of upbeat photographers that detail the finer points of Australian lifestyle. Photojournalism has become less respected as it is more of an accessible art form, but industry insiders are determined to make it complementary to the works that have for so long headlined our newspapers. The 2010 winner of the 54th World Press Photo of the Year was South African journalist Jodie Bieber, with a portrait of an 18-year-old Afghani woman, Aisha, who was left brutally disfigured after being attacked by her husband and brother-in-law. And for the State reporter Nathan Coates went along to, after speaking to Jodie Bieber from Johannesburg.
The winning image, of course, by Jodie Bieber is a young lady from Afghanistan who's had her nose and ears cut off because she dared to stray from her husband back to her family. And she was convicted by a Taliban court, held down, and her husband and brother-in-law removed her nose and her ears. I mean, it's a truly shocking photograph. You know, she shows great strength of character to be allowed to be photographed like this.
Alan Davies is the curator of photographs at the State Library.
I went to Women for Afghan Women's Shelter and I met with the director. It had been set up that we were going to meet. And the director said Aisha could be quite sensitive to the photograph, and if at any time she feels uncomfortable, we would need to stop. And I was with my translator, and Aisha was with a social worker.
You look at the photo, you see a beautiful young woman, then you see her predicament and you wonder what's happened.
Oh, exactly. What's happened? How did this take place? Why? You know, when you read on, you become extremely angry. These things should not take place.
And we went into a very nondescript room, which had red carpets, a fan, and nothing else really to describe Aisha. I just spoke to Aisha first very about arbitrary things, like, is she looking forward to one day going to have a nose done? And, you know, just to make her feel comfortable. And then I started photographing, and I didn't feel it was working out. So I put down my camera, and I really just said to Aisha, through the translator, of course, because I had noticed she was very, very beautiful. And I said, for a few moments, could she just think about her inner power and her inner beauty, and let's create a photograph where she, I don't know, I suppose, comes from a place of power. And that's when I took the photograph, and that's when that happened.
The image was on the front cover of Time magazine in 2010, accompanied by the headline, What Happens If We Leave Afghanistan?
It was very much through, I'd say, a collaboration and a discussion with Aisha that created that photograph. The photograph is symbolic, or not even symbolic, of violence against women, but I don't think it's only violence against women in Afghanistan. I think that many, many women, and I've noticed this as I've been traveling to open the exhibition in different countries, are relating to it. You know, I'm thrilled that basically the jury made the decision to choose that photograph and weren't cut up over the headline, because really, it is another kind of war. It's a war that can happen, I suppose, or it does happen in the houses in Australia as it does in South Africa and Afghanistan, just in different proportions and different extremes. So it means that, but I think it's also symbolic, maybe of darkness and light, and about beauty and the beast. Everyone manipulated or had their own point of view depending on their own political beliefs, their own economics, and how they felt they could utilize, you know, either the photograph alone or the photograph and the headline together. And no one had the same point of view. So for me, in a way, it was a catalyst that created huge discussion and huge debate. And I think that was the most important thing, actually.
I have to admit, there are some very confronting images, some images which, you know, you have to look through it, you know, fingers sometimes. They're so dreadful. But it's the reality of life in the world. War zones, dreadful natural catastrophes. These things are covered by these photographers. It's not a matter of infotainment, it's reality. In 2010, of course, it was the Haiti disaster. There's one photograph which just... I don't know, it's very hard to take. It's a man cleaning up, basically, dressed in a white suit and gloves, and he's throwing bodies onto a heap. In this case, it's a young child he's throwing onto a heap, as if he's a refuse or garbage man. This one's a Brazilian photographer, Alexander Vieira, and he got an honourable mention in his Spot News, and he was clearly just on the spot when a murder took place, and basically the guy that was shot managed to pull his gun out as well and start shooting his attacker. And at one stage, you see the attacker is actually running towards the photographer. So the man on the ground who's pulled his gun out is shooting directly at the photographer. The thing finishes up with both individuals being killed. This one's by Reinhard de Scherl. Compositionally, it's extraordinary.
Are there any from the 1440, the Sydney Morning Herald exhibition, that you especially
like?
Oh,
look, there's an absolute outstanding image there. Let's go and have a look. Kate Geraghty is better known for her war photography, but here she's covering the flood at Corinda, which is up near Walgett. That's an aerial photograph looking down on all those rolls of hay that you see in the countryside floating around in this almost monochromatic flood. And the sort of bales look like they're floating in space. You have to look twice to sort of understand what you're looking at. But it's an extraordinary image.
1440, this is its second year. We exhibit in conjunction with World Press Photo, which I think is a terrific fit. A couple of years ago, I wanted to put on an exhibition for the photographers. I was seeing all these fabulous photos come through every day that weren't getting published, and I wanted to be able to give these photos a voice, so to speak.
Managing Editor of Photography at the Sydney Morning Herald, Sandra Harrison.
There's nothing international, because I think up against World Press Photo, we needed to look different. It's a very heavy exhibition, World Press Photo. It's a very worthy and a very, very good exhibition, and it's the best of the world. So we needed to complement that, but also stand on our own two feet as a completely separate exhibition. So therefore, everything at 1440 is in colour. There's no black and white. You'll have two different emotional feelings. I think you'll get a bit of a laugh out of some of the photos at 1440, and you'll feel quite warm about them. And then you'll go into World Press, and you'll feel it is quite a depressing but excellent exhibition. One of my favourite photos in the exhibition is actually a bride walking through Hyde Park with her husband. She's all decked out, and it is absolutely pouring rain. It is torrential, and she is laughing her head off. She's got the worst weather on the best day of her life, and she just doesn't care. And it's just a lovely, warm photo. We hadn't commissioned that photo. Our photographer just saw that when she was out and about, and we pulled the whole paper apart so we could get that in the paper on page 3. It was a terrific shot.
Photojournalism threatened by just-in-time photography that you might, you know, typically see utilised online, and the growth in citizen journalism, bloggers?
No, absolutely not. If you had have asked me that question 2 years ago, I might have had a different answer. More people are shooting photos, for sure, but I think more people are interested in it. Photography has become a lot more accessible to people through whether it's an iPhone or through cameras that they've bought themselves, but it's no longer expensive with film and dark rooms and getting printing done and stuff. It can be all done at home on your home computer. So I think it's actually made people more aware and more interested in the art form of photojournalism.
Interestingly, we have found over the 10 years that we've had it at the library that the under 35s love it. They flock in. I think it's sort of a rejection of the infotainment they get with television, the sort of nonsense stories that are said to represent world news.
More people are shooting photos, for sure, but I think more people are interested in it. Photography has become a lot more accessible to people through whether it's an iPhone or through cameras that they've bought themselves, but it's no longer expensive with film and dark rooms and getting printing done and stuff. It can be all done at home on your home computer. So I think it's actually made people more aware and more interested in the art form of photojournalism.
Sandra Harrison is responsible for the photo department at the Sydney Morning Herald, ended that report, coming from Nathan Coates.
Harvey Norman's massive Aussie forest clearance is on now! Don't miss this when you buy imported Harvey Norman furniture, your Aussie forests slack!
No Harvey, no is the catch cry of advocacy group Get Up after a year-long research foray released some rather scathing evidence. GetUp has taken the infectious jingle that represents the major retail chain of Harvey Norman and subsequently faced censorship with decisions not to air the No Harvey No ad campaign during the State of Origin and across the board on commercial television.
Take action now and save! Save Aussie forests, save Aussie wildlife, save Aussie climate! Help change Harvey Norman!
So check out the final clip. Head along to noharveyno.net. Keen to watch the Nutcracker live on Facebook? Before you dismiss the idea, you may soon be able to, following the Australian Ballet's turn towards social media in an effort to engage with its audience. The Art Council of Australia conducted research into the way that arts organisations are able to take on the digital era via Facebook, YouTube and its own blog. The Australian Ballet has been leaps and bounds ahead, going behind the scenes to give audiences a better perspective of its industry, as well as having a forum for audience discussion and opinion, both before and after the shows. Annie Wiley spoke to the Marketing and Communications Director from the Australian Ballet, Kate Scott.
For us, social media was really a tool to engage with ballet fans all over the country, even when they weren't able to see us performing on stage.
And what have you actually done in order to use social media in that way?
We're probably about 2 years now on that we're getting to having a Facebook page, which is actually a really central place that people come online to discuss shows after they've closed. As soon as we open up a performance, we post a gallery of photographs from the production of itself, which is a really great way of involving everyone who was maybe sitting in the stalls the night before or is, you know, in regional Victoria looking at a gallery on their iPhone. We also do a series of kind of mini documentaries every year between 6 and 8 that highlight different aspects of the company, whether it's how dancers treat their point shoes before they go on stage, how a technical team bumps in a performance, even on how we get 69 dancers on a plane to another country to do an international tour. So those are all ways that we're able to engage with audiences, you know, on a daily basis, really.
Why is engagement with the audience so important?
It's always been a central plank of what the Australian Ballet has done since the very beginning, which is about 50 years ago. For us, you know, it's important to sell tickets to a show, but it's also really important to get people excited about ballet and about dance generally. And, you know, ballet is an art form that goes back hundreds of years and it's always changing. You need to have mechanisms where people can feel the way that it's changing and see the way that a company like us changes over the years and brings a particularly Australian perspective, I suppose, to this art form.
I noticed in the research that the Australia Council for the Arts did that it seemed you guys did notice an increase in sales post the publication of photos or video on the Facebook page or the YouTube site. What are your thoughts on that?
I've got to say it wasn't the intention from the outset, but once we really got into a groove of having regular people who were visiting the page, probably even about 3 months in, we were noticing that when we did upload a gallery, that we'd see a sales spike. And not always, but with certain productions where it really is about the visual impact of what you see on stage, then definitely, you know, noticeably we'd see, you know, the sales come in from the next day and we wouldn't have done anything else except post the gallery. So that's been incredibly exciting.
Do you think it's become almost a try before you buy sort of situation?
Yeah, and I think when you're dealing in visual art forms as well, I mean, it's really, really hard to communicate how a performance is going to feel in a newspaper press ad. And you can promise lots of things, but I think seeing the full impact of, you know, the point of a shoe on a floor, or, you know, the detail in a tutu, or, you know, the sheer scale of a production on stage, that provokes a really emotional response in people.
Do you have any sort of after production follow-up on the social media pages?
I guess there's a lot of conversation that happens about the particular shows, and often those galleries are a launching pad for that discussion. So people will comment on different casts that they've seen, because there can be upwards of 5 different casts dancing 1 different ballet. There's a lot of discussion that people have about their favourite parts of the ballet. We tend not to involve ourselves too much in that discussion. We kind of like to sit back and let people talk amongst themselves, because I think that's where a lot of the most interesting conversation happens. But, you know, for seasons, we've actually, with their permission, but incorporated some of those comments into marketing material as well.
Why did the Australian Ballet choose social media as a pretty much a marketing tool, given that social media's main demographic is the younger population of Australia?
That's really interesting, and I know that that's probably the pervasive feeling, but it's not something that we've seen on our own page. I mean, the most active people that we really see are some of those people have been coming to our performances for decades, and I don't think that's a barrier. I don't think age is a barrier for those people being active in that space. A lot of them are, you know, the parents or the grandparents or the great aunts of dancers in the company. You know, there's lots of dance students as well. And then there's those people who, you know, might be in their 60s or their 70s or even their 80s. And then there's a big spread in between as well.
Is this process on social media being used mainly for contemporary productions?
No, we use it pretty heavily for everything. There was a few years ago, we had a particular contemporary season with 3 world premiere works, brand new sets, brand new costumes, brand new scores. It's incredibly hard to let people know what they might expect with a show like that. So that was the first season that we really used social media heavily to really open up our building and let people know how these works were being created, the kind of interactions that were happening in the studio, the costumes as they were being made. That was a success as well, where we saw an impact on sales. But since then, we've used it for both contemporary and classical ballets.
Do you think that the use of social media perhaps detracts from the appeal of going to the ballet as sort of an old-fashioned night out, and that sort of same with going to the theatre, that sort of thing?
We've had a really great last few years, and that's been the same period we've been on social media, so it definitely hasn't detracted from it from that angle. I don't know. I think there's always been a curiosity back to the early days of the company, and people have actively, you know, wanted to know more about the company. We've had people coming in and photographing kind of amateur photographers since the very early days, you know, hustling their way in for no other reason than they wanted to get that bit closer and have a bit more insight into what was happening. So I don't think it does. It's just a different way of looking at things, and perhaps a bit more detailed and a bit more colourful than you would have got in the past.
Do you think that social media has opened some markets for you, though?
Yeah, interesting. I don't know if it's opened them. I mean, word of mouth is obviously the great upshot of social media. It means that if you've got a great show, people who might not have otherwise heard of it or might not have otherwise, made the effort to come and see a show, if they've got somebody that they trust who recommends it, or they've seen a great photo that really strikes a chord with them, they'll come along. I think conversely, if you've got a show that perhaps isn't particularly strong, word will get out pretty fast as well on that front. So, it doesn't always work in the favour of the company, and I think that's good. I think it's just a more honest, it gives people a more honest assessment of what they can expect without necessarily waiting 4 days for a press review to come out.
Social media has been used to put the pre-production process online.
Yeah.
Will I ever be streaming Ballet Live from the comfort of my own home?
Interestingly, we just stepped out with our first live streaming in May this year. So there is a yearly choreographic exploration program that we do at Sydney Theatre called Body Talk. And that was live streamed very first time and now is available to view on demand by Big Pond. And it was a huge success for us. You know, more people watched the streaming than we were able to physically squeeze into the theatre. So it's definitely something we'll be doing more of in the future.
For the States, Annie Wiley was speaking there to Kate Scott from the Australian Ballet about making music in social media. Well, it seems that kids are seeing just as many junk food ads as they were 2 years ago when industry self-regulation was introduced. The quick service restaurant industry's pledge to responsibly advertise and market to children began back in 2009, and the signatories include KFC, Pizza Hut and McDonald's. A Sydney University study compared the number of ads just before and about a year after this pledge, finding this isn't cutting the mustard. As Natasha Egan reported, beginning by speaking to dietitian and lead researcher of the study, Lara Hebden.
One of the main findings was that fast food advertising actually increased over this time period, and the more important finding was that fast food advertising unhealthy foods and drinks remained the same, whereas we would have actually expected to see a drop in these as a result of this pledge being introduced.
I read an interview in QSR Media with Dr. Ennison from the Australian Food and Grocery Council.
Yep.
And he's made a comment that your research shows that advertising of healthy foods has gone up and that proportionally unhealthy food advertising has actually gone down. And he says from 95 to 67%. Is this true?
So proportionally, yes, the proportion of unhealthy fast food ads had gone down. But this is actually quite a deceiving measure. And what we actually measured in our study was the frequency at which fast food ads were shown. And this is a much better measure because what it's actually measuring is one's exposure to fast food advertising on commercial television. So because over the study period, the number of fast food ads increased in their frequency, whereas unhealthy fast food ads stayed the same, proportionally, it looks like the proportion of fast food ads that were unhealthy decreased. But in terms of what people were exposed to, the number of unhealthy fast food ads remained the same, and that's what's important.
And another point that was made in that article by Dr. Ennison was that your journal article failed to clearly define what advertising for children is regarding viewing hours and program types. Therefore, it couldn't be used as an argument that greater regulation is required. Was the advertising for children defined?
Yeah, we did define advertising to children. In the study recently published in the Medical Journal of Australia, we defined advertisements directed towards children using an objective measure of children's exposure, which was audience data. And that's what we really need in order to define advertisements that children are being exposed to. We need to base this on objective measures such as audience data. And the way that we defined it was time periods where at least 25% or greater of the maximum child audience for the day were watching. And by defining it in that way, we are specifically looking at those time periods where the highest numbers of kids are watching and where the maximum amount of exposure can occur.
That was lead author Lana Hebden. She and the other authors say that because the impact of self-regulation is so limited, greater government regulation of fast food advertising is needed. And Professor Greg Johnson from the Australian Chronic Disease Prevention Alliance agrees. He says he's not surprised that kids' exposure to junk food ads is the same as before self-regulation, and actually it's confirmed what they already thought.
This study that's just been released shows, in fact, the failure of self-regulation. And, you know, despite industry claims about responsible advertising to our children. We've seen absolutely no change to the huge volume of advertising of unhealthy foods and sugary drinks to our children.
What does all this junk food advertising actually mean to children's health?
Well, we believe there's good evidence of a strong association between the very high level, the huge amount of targeted marketing and advertising of unhealthy foods and sugary beverages to our kids, and childhood obesity, overweight and obesity. And unfortunately, we have one in four children in Australia who's overweight or obese. And unfortunately, obese children tend to become obese adults and then develop at a much faster rate chronic diseases, such as type 2 diabetes, cardiovascular disease, kidney disease, and indeed some cancers. So, the association between this high level of marketing and promotion of unhealthy foods is strong with a very significant problem of weight gain across all of our society and the rise of chronic disease.
And now you join the authors, or your organisation joins the authors' call for tougher government regulations, don't you?
Well, the Australian Chronic Disease Prevention Alliance includes Diabetes Australia, the Heart Foundation, Cancer Council Australia, Kidney Health Australia and the Stroke Foundation. And we're calling for the government to now get serious and put an end to the industry self-regulation charade and introduce mandatory restrictions that will make a real difference.
What kind of restrictions? What would you like to see?
Well, they need to be enforceable measures. We currently operate in a self-regulatory regime where there's no enforceability. And so what we see regularly is advertisers and companies breaching their own codes, and then they say, oh, sorry, that was a mistake. And there's just no outcome. Nothing changes.
I guess, what is the ideal situation? Like no junk food advertising at all, or what kind of measures would be appropriate?
Oh, okay. Yes, well, there have been good platforms put forward for how the unhealthy, food marketing of sugary drinks and unhealthy foods during peak children's viewing time. And there should be, serious restrictions on the other range. And one of the important things to remember is this is not just about television advertising, this problem. We have all the new media, websites and emails and all sorts of new technologies and Facebooks and those things. And we see lots of evidence of very sophisticated marketing techniques being used to promote unhealthy foods and sugary drinks to our children in all sorts of ways. So it's not just a simplistic thing about what's on television, but there needs to be enforceable rules and clear restrictions on what is a huge volume of television advertising of unhealthy foods and sugary drinks.
That was Professor Greg Johnson from the Australian Chronic Disease Alliance, who ended that report coming from Natasha Egan. And if you liked that story, go along to our website for thestateradio.blogspot.com and download your very own copy of it. And that wraps up the For the State for another week. But indeed, the news of the world will continue to speculate and sensationalise what the hell's going on in the hacking world. Time now just to give thanks to the University of Technology Sydney's Faculty of Humanities and Social Sciences and Macquarie University's Arts Department for offering up financial support to the Fourth Estate. Drop us a line anytime. The email is fourthestate@2ser.com. And you can follow us on Twitter with our username 4TH Estate Radio. So I hope to catch you again next week. But until then, I'm Mick Caldwell. Take care.